Jesus Christ. There is a clickbait that says, what the Avengers Infinity War trailer needs. Fuck my dick right off.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From San Diego, California, my co-host, Keith Foster.
I think it's really weird how you introduce me where I'm from, because I always expect you to introduce yourself, Cassidy Robinson from Los Angeles, California.
Okay, so the holidays are upon us. We are balls deep into holiday season 2017.
Yes, we are.
It's happening. And the Christmas songs are already playing.
Okay, I know you want to talk about that. Mm-hmm. You want to talk about holiday bullshit, but
no,
not really. I have to get this off my chest. I was opening the movie news articles, and I saw a little clickbait article. This is the day we're recording this. The day before the Avengers Infinity War trailer drops, and there's literally a clickbait article. This says, what the Avengers Infinity War trailer needs. And you know what I think? I think maybe repealing net neutrality is not the worst idea. Like, I'm fucking done. I am so done with the internet. We're writing, like, this took up internet space. Mm-hmm. This fucking article.
See, here's the thing, Keith. And I know this because I briefly worked for one of those companies that wrote that kind of bullshit.
They just need the clicks.
They need those clicks. And the thing, like, it's worse than 24-hour news. It's like omnipresent news. Because even when the offices close and you go home, there's a lot of editors and stuff who are still working on the clock. Like, they're like, you know, OBGYNs who have to, like, wait for their pager to buzz to go take care of a baby being birthed at any moment. So, you know, if Johnny Depp gets caught drunk driving in Paris with an Olsen twin, then somebody at 3 a.m. has to wake up and write the damn article, then send it to an editor who has to wake up and edit the article and post it before all the other sites do it.
I get that. If Johnny Depp does happen to do that, the long wait is almost over for the first look at Marvel's next team-up. The first glimpse at Marvel Studios. Shut the fuck up. This is an article.
About a trailer, yeah.
About what people are anticipating from a trailer.
Right. What are they anticipating, Keith? What does the article say?
It doesn't have bullet points, so TLDR. this is even worse. It doesn't have like a bullet point listicle format of like what we're looking forward to: Iron Man's new suit, Chris Evans' beard, blonde Black Widow, blah blah blah. It like shows it's like broken by author, so it's to keep that anticipation going, the team at Heat Vision, don't know what that is, don't give a fuck, is looking ahead to Wednesday's debut and what to expect. So then breaks it up by who the team is. Mm-hmm. You know what? I don't give a fuck. I don't give a fuck what a single one of these people thinks.
But you don't follow Heat Vision.
No, I don't even know what that is.
I don't either. I think it might be a news like blog site or something.
It's going to go under in 6 months, so fuck them.
All right. So there's that. You're mad at the internet. That's your news.
I really am, actually.
More specifically, just bullshit articles that are about nothing?
No, I mean, that is just a symptom. I'm mad at Facebook. I'm mad at Twitter. I'm mad at it all. And I just look at it all day long.
Because that's what we do.
I legitimately think that okay, obviously, rolling back the rules on net neutrality, in all seriousness, is horrible. I don't know if we can prevent it this time. If there's a chance that we can, it is worth writing to your senators. It is worth the phone calls. However, it's not the issue people make it out to be. I think healthcare is a bigger issue. I think the fucking tax cuts are a bigger issue. I honestly think if we had some restricted internet shit, if it cost more money, maybe people would tune out a little bit, and that might be a good thing.
So no, Keith, I'm serious. Keith's controversial opinion on the beginning and end of net neutrality.
I think the internet's gone too far. I'm sick of people's fucking dumb shit opinions. Mm-hmm. I'm sick of how much the internet and social media plays an active role in our lives when it absolutely should not, the way it does. It fucking helped influence an election last year. The last couple years. I'm just saying, we'll survive. I mean, this podcast won't. That's for sure.
No, 100% won't. And that's what I'm a little bit more worried about. And also, I would be much more concerned about the fact that the major corporations that own the mainstream news outlets, which are doing a terrible job and have been doing a terrible job for a really long time, would have the monopoly on the news that we consume, which I can see the positives of because it removes weird fake Russian news, but it also removes like the hardcore muckrakers who are doing good work out there.
Of course, I'm being hyperbolic and I don't actually think that it's a good thing. Mm-hmm. This is more of a cry for sanity than a cry for the repeal of net neutrality.
Good, because what I wanted to talk about, speaking of weird shit on the internet, is I saw there's this picture that's going around of the guy who owns Jimmy John's restaurants. Have you seen this?
Yeah, I saw that. This is old news. I saw this like a year ago.
Of him being like one of those big game hunters.
Yeah, and him fucking the shark?
Yeah, what's the deal with him fucking the shark?
Like, okay, first of all...
Like, they're,
first,
like that... Like,
no.
I get it. Okay. Like, rich people, they have too much money. They don't know what to do with it. They just have to go kill something that's bigger than them. Like, okay, I don't agree with it, and I don't want them to do that. Obviously, I don't like seeing pictures of that. But why the fuck is he fucking a dead shark? And why the fuck did somebody take that picture? What is going on? I want to know the whole story behind that day and that picture.
Okay, specifically speaking to him fucking a shark, it is not confirmed that that's him. It is one of those things where it was like this photo came out and somebody was like, doesn't that look like the dude from Jimmy John's? And he is a big game hunter and a douchebag. That would make sense that he would fuck a shark, but it's not confirmed that that's him. And if you look at his face, it does look slightly different than his face in the other photos. That's all I'm saying. It very well could be him. But I also am saying that social media justice... I don't need to try this guy guilty of shark fucking based off of one out of context photo.
I'm convinced. I'm convinced.
I mean, here's the thing. It's probably him.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know for sure that it's him. So I'm not going to fly off the handle and say he's a shark fucker. I mean, he is a big game hunter and a total douchebag.
Mm-hmm.
And I just saw this fucking video about how smart elephants are after Donald Trump's whole repeal the elephant hunting thing.
He ended up not doing that. But yeah, I saw a video also about how smart bees are. So we gotta figure out like what animals we are okay with being smart and Jesus also Christ. Killing.
You are all over the place tonight, Cass. I have a whole thing on bees, too.
You're going to have to hold your bee rant because we got to move on to the movie news. All we can do is review the Justice League movie, Lady Bird, which you just got out of.
Literally. I just got home 20 minutes ago from it.
Uh-huh. And at the end of the program, we're going to review an October Netflix review of the Michael Haneke's Funny Games, the U.S. remake. But before we do that, movie news.
Movie news. news. Talking about that movie news.
Ugh, okay.
And we'll start off with this one. There's going to be another Spider-Man spinoff in the... I'm guessing this is the Sony Spider-Universe that they're trying to make happen. Done by the writers who did the Power Rangers reboot that just came out about a lesser-known Spider-Man villain called Morbius, the Living Vampire. Okay. You know what, though? I'd say if it didn't have to do with Spider-Man and it was just a Morbius movie, I would kind of sort of be into this. Because I think I think that's one of those characters who's kind of a shitty D-list, like, Marvel character that update pretty easily and make cool.
And there, without the context of, like, superhero, sure, I guess. I
could actually see, like, this, not so much the, whatever, the Spider-Man, like, Sinister Six movie, whatever. I don't know what's going on over there anymore with the Venom movie and all this bullshit. But I could see this being, like, a pretty okay, like, direct-to-Netflix series, if they wanted to go that route.
No, I think it's going to be a movie, but...
Yeah.
No, here's the thing. I'm reserving all judgment on the Spider-Man cinematic universe until we see more about Venom, because I have no idea what the fuck this even means. It's a Spider-Man cinematic universe, but is Spider-Man for Marvel in it? Is it going to have Spider-Man? I don't know. So I'm reserving all judgment on anything that says Spider-Man spinoff until we start to see more details about any of it. They can talk about in the works, movies, bullshit, dick farts, whatever, all they want. To me, this is the same as the dark cinematic movie universe that shit the bed with the Mummy. Don't give no fucks, and it's all going to be on the line with whatever they give us first. So until I know anything about Venom, this is just noise to me.
I think Don't Give No Fucks is the new Rihanna single.
Well, then I should hear it, because this might be my new anthem for 2017.
Okay, the other unnecessary thing that's happening in media. Lord of the Rings TV series is in the works with Amazon.
What does that even mean?
That's a good question.
We have the movies!
We have a lot of movies. We have so much Middle-Earth DVD stuff out there.
We have three really good Lord of the Rings movies right now. We have three mediocre to not great Hobbit movies. And we have two really good Middle-Earth-based Peter Jackson-esque video games.
Right. And you're not even counting like the Rankin Bass cartoons or the Ralph Bakshi.
No. This is all like modern Lord of the Rings shit.
Right.
Which those movies came out when we were in fucking high school. So I just don't know what they want. What do they want from me as a consumer?
You know, it's weird. Like, time is a funny, tricky thing because I don't feel like those movies are old, but I also occasionally talk to people who are a good 10 years younger than me, and the way that I think about the movies from my teenage years is not the way they think about them. Like, they think of the Lord of the Rings movies, probably.
They can still watch them.
Or the Matrix, or like whatever. They probably think of the, like, that turn of the century sort of blockbuster stuff as the same way we thought about like John Hughes movies when we were in high school.
I still watch John Hughes movies.
I did, yeah.
And now these movies are literally available at the click of a button.
You know what is, though? This has nothing to do with bringing the Tolkien mythology to a new generation who's too lazy to watch movies.
We're going to milk the tits of a recognizable franchise as much as possible.
Oh, no. This is even more specific than that. Yes, obviously, there's a recognizable IP that's being exploited. But also, this is, we want that Game of Thrones Mun-Muns. Amazon wants to compete with Game of Thrones, and this is the way they think they're going to do it.
There's so much other fantasy universes and rich, like, there's, go to a fucking library.
Right? Like,
look at all the books on the shelves.
Mm-hmm.
Pick one that we don't have all this shit for already. Like, I don't need, don't want.
But there is a, like...
Don't need, don't want.
There's a lot of geeks out there who are still waiting for their Wheel of Time series.
Yeah, do that. Let's try rebooting the failed Golden Compass bullshit. Like, I was kind of interested in where that was going.
Mm-hmm.
Left me hanging there. Like, seriously, let's find anything else.
Spiderwick Chronicles?
What about that Dune reboot that's supposed to be going on? Like,
that's still happening, actually. Denis Villeneuve, I think, is going to do that.
Well, I'm into that. But, you know, yeah. There's, like, 8 Dune books. Like, there's yeah. so... And this is literally just the sci-fi that we can, like, pick off the top of our brains from memory.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many of these things. Like, literally, George R. R. Martin has other... fucking franchise books. If you want something that's like Game of Thrones, mm-hmm. maybe pick something else by the author of Game of Thrones.
So let's go ahead and segue in from that conversation right into Justice League.
Sorry, I was drinking water.
That's okay.
I'm getting fired up tonight.
You are. So salty today.
Oh, Jesus.
Just
let's get into it.
Yeah. Do you wanna set this up? Why don't you set up Justice League?
Okay. So Justice League is a direct sequel to Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice. It is the DC extended universe limping along. We had Batman v Superman, then we got Suicide Squad, which is tangentially related, I guess, then Wonder Woman, and then this is the direct sequel to Batman v Superman. Mm-hmm. Batman feels guilty because he didn't kill Superman, and he feels like he has to enlist the aid of other metahumans in order to stop a world-ending threat that he has somehow learned about.
Mm-hmm.
And then he assembles the League, and then they fight bad monsters.
Essentially, yeah. Justice League, which is also directed by Zack Snyder. We talked about this on the show a little while ago about how Zack Snyder mostly directed it, but then at the very end, he had to deal with family stuff, and Joss Whedon came to sort of finish up the job.
And
people are really speculating how much Whedon is in there, how much kind of script doctoring, blah, 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 blah. We don't really know. I try not to think about that stuff too much. I think the end product is the end product.
Here's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Every major DC Universe movie that's come out
has one of these stories.
Besides Wonder Woman,
mm-hmm.
the fans have been clamoring for, oh, but there's a director's cut that's magically good.
Right.
There. You have to admit that there's problems when every time these movies underperform based off the anticipation, and every time you're saying, but that's not what the director wanted. There's a better version out there somewhere.
Agreed. So a few of the things I guess work here.
You're just going right into it.
You already set it up. We can go right into it. The few things that I think work here is it narratively makes sense, unlike, say, Batman v Superman, where you could take any one scene and rearrange it with another scene, and by the end of the movie, you'd still have a movie that made about as much sense. And unlike Suicide Squad, which was, you know, just totally studio fucked into oblivion until it was just a weird mutant disgrace of what it was supposed to be or who even knows. This movie has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It has a very simple structure as far as like one of these kind of superhero things. There's, like you set it up there, you know. Batman discovers creepy aliens. He says there needs to be a Justice League. He puts them together in, you know, in that sort of Seven Samurai sort of way. And then by the end of the movie, you know, blah, blah, blah. There's a big thing and they have to stop it and who cares? And there's, you know, some mystical villain that looks like garbage and who cares. But at least as a story, it follows pretty easily.
I'm going to kind of disagree with you there.
Well, I'm not saying that everything, all the characters' motivations are perfectly clear. But I mean, as you're watching it, I never at one point in the movie said, "Why is this happening?"
You didn't?
Nah, not really. I mean, basically the answer ever in a Zack Snyder movie when you're asking that is because it looks cool.
I will say. Yes, if we're comparing it to Batman v Superman and Suicide Squad, mm-hmm. then yes, narratively it makes sense.
It makes more sense. I'll say that.
If we're comparing it to storytelling,
well, storytelling and plot structure are two very different things.
Okay. So you're saying the plot structure, I'm just saying
the structure of the bones of the movie, the foundation of why one scene transitioned to another, it basically follows. Not in any way that's at all exciting or new or original, but it at least follows. Like, I could see this structure being applied to one of those direct-to-DVD, like, animated movies.
Okay.
And well, you'd be like, okay, it's kind of basic, but it works.
Right now we're having a semantic argument that is not even
no.
what either of us really want to say.
No. I'm not even saying these are the things that are good about it, because I don't think it's a very good movie at all. But I'm saying these are the reasons why people think they like it more than they do.
Oh, Jesus Christ, you're so condescending.
Well, the other thing that people think they're responding to is...
No, people like it. They just... It's not that people think they like it. People like it.
Give them 3 years, and we'll see how people really feel about the movie. Right now,
really?
I think they're a little drunk on the hype. But and not a lot of people, but the ones who are... You know, are very vocal.
I'm just saying, you can't read people's minds.
The other thing that they think they're responding to more than they actually are has quote unquote jokes. They think they like the jokes, and there's this there's thing online for a long time. The big narrative following the DC universe, besides the fact that they're, you know, is kind of a mess, and there's always one of these what was the script actually supposed to be stories. The other thing is that and I actually blame the critics about this. We talk about a lot the Jar Jar Binks effect, which is when you point out a thing in a movie that doesn't work as being the ultimate reason why the movie is a problem, and it's usually it's usually just a symptom of a larger problem.
Yes, like everyone said Batman v Superman was too dark.
Too dark.
And so they're like, okay, well, we're going to lighten this up and add jokes. Air quotes jokes.
Yes.
Can we stop using the phrase jokes? These aren't jokes.
No. And you know, even though we talked to, I mentioned the thing about, like, you know, there was script doctoring and Joss Whedon's involvement, and, you know, we don't really know which part of the dialogue came from him and which came from Zack Snyder or Chris Terrio, who co-wrote the movie as well. There's like 9 writing credits on this thing. But to me, the movie feels very punched up. It feels like there's a normal superhero scene or whatever, and then at the very end they have to tag on a punchline somewhere.
Yes. I just want it out there for the record that a punch up is different than a joke.
Yes.
A joke is a setup and a punchline. A punch up is we feel like this moment it could have something light or something funny, but that's different than a joke.
Yeah, the jokes are inserted in the movie inappropriately. They're not put in organically. They're not based in character. They're not based on the motivations of the characters or where the scene was going.
But that's the problem. That's the problem with calling the. That's the problem with calling humor in a movie like Thor Ragnarok a joke. Those aren't jokes. It's a humorous movie.
Right.
It's a comedic movie. There's a tone to it. That's not the same as a joke.
Right.
A stand-up comedian tells jokes. And even within jokes, there's, you know, subsets and categories. So just let's stop using the term jokes, because then we get things like this movie.
Exactly. And I think
where they're telling jokes.
Exactly. And I think that people are responding to to the humor in the movie. And I don't think all of it's bad. I think, you know, I think that there's some stuff. The two biggest performance standouts for me was from Ezra Miller as the Flash. I just wanted a Flash movie by the end of this. I was just like, I could have just had a Flash movie and been a lot happier. And I think Gal Gadot still has a little bit, there's still a little bit of enthusiasm from her. I don't think she's as strong here as she is in the Wonder Woman movie, obviously for directing reasons and because she doesn't have as much to do.
Okay. So, now that we're talking about Gal Gadot, I just want to go on record and saying that all of the 9 writers involved in this, and this is a little bit sad because, you know, Joss Whedon has worked on this and he's sort of known for writing strong female characters. They don't know how to write women in this movie at all. Like, it's painful, almost. Like, Wonder Woman, the movie was really good. This was like, she has some of the most cringeworthy lines for me. Her, between her, Lois Lane, and Ma Kent, like, if you just watched their parts of this movie, I think you'd be really grossed out.
And bored as fuck.
Yeah.
Every time Lois Lane, Amy Adams, steps in the movie, and this isn't like a big, you know, dig on Amy Adams. Well, I have mixed feelings about, but I generally never find her a problem. In this movie, she is. And in so far, all the DC movies, she has been. And every time she walks in this movie, it's like, we don't need you.
No, not at all. And literally, yeah. Okay. Let's keep going about stuff we liked. I agree.
I'm out. That's all I got. Those aren't even things I would say I liked. Those are the reasons why I think that the movie is being seen slightly more positively than the others. And I think the things that I guess are improvements, but I actually think that the humor in this movie most of the time doesn't work. I think, you know, they're trying to go for like a Marvel-esque lighthearted banter, but I think some of the punchlines in this comes off like fucking Batman and Robin style corniness.
Yeah, it's really awkward and stilted. Most of it. Okay, here's so I'm a part of a comic book chat group on Facebook. And someone asked for a pros and cons of Justice League. So, and that actually helped me put it into a little bit of perspective because I didn't loathe this movie like I hated Batman v Superman.
No.
Dawn of Justice. I honestly think that that is my least favorite modern, like, big blockbuster movie. Possibly of all time. But Justice League, it's not as bad. And there was some stuff that I liked about it. One was the Flash. I agree. Yeah. I'm a little bit excited for Ezra Miller's own Flash movie, which he might still be getting, even though this underperformed. I really like the casting of Jason Momoa as Aquaman and just the take of him being like this sort of
brutish,
swarthy, almost piratey King of the Seas. But you see all of his good moments in the trailer, and they do some really confusing stuff with him going to Atlantis that just it bogged his character down for me, and I was frustrated by that because I like his costume design, I like his look, I like Jason Momoa in the role. I feel like they could have used him more. Like, why wasn't the fucking end set piece, like, on an island where he could summon sharks or, like, a giant squid or, you know, he could actually use his fucking power? Hey, let's take Aquaman and have Batman recruit him for some reason, even though we're not going to do shit on the water.
Right.
Like, that's fucking stupid. Let's not. Why is he even there? What's the point of him? So that frustrated me. I thought the characters were all right. I thought the cast was good, except for Batfleck, who I was patient with. I gave the benefit of the doubt with Batman v Superman.
Right.
Not in this. He's garbage. He is phoning it in like I haven't seen him ever.
He's so boring. And I thought that in Batman v Superman too. And there's a lot of people who are like, oh, I don't know. I don't know where this comes from, but they are responding to it in a way that that perplexes me, because to me, he is asleep in this movie.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. I think there's a difference between him in this movie and Batman v Superman. I think he was genuinely enthusiastic about Batman v Superman. I think he was there for it, and it just happened to be a bad movie happened around him. Mm-hmm. That happened, and so I think he just never cared about this. He completely checked out. He's already getting out of the franchise.
Right.
He just phones it the fuck in. I don't think he has a genuine moment of anything even resembling Batman or excitement. He is he's bland man. I did really like that finally, fucking finally, we get to see Superman in an actual blue and red suit.
Okay.
I still think he should have had the goddamn little booty shorts, because that costume just looks weird without some kind of red breaking up the middle. At least give him like a red belt, whatever. But they don't mute the color palette in this movie.
I know what you're
saying. That's where this movie is at, right? That I'm talking about the fucking color palette.
Okay. Well, yeah, because to me that, I mean, it's both literally and figuratively a cosmetic fix. Like, that to me, that's again, like, oh, everyone hated Batman v Superman because it's dark. Well, let's put in jokes. Like, to me, that's like the same kind of thing. It's like, well, if we make Superman blue, then people will assume that it's a more positive movie going experience. And I actually like low key sort of enjoyed Man of Steel until the 9/11 porn at the end. But I thought that Henry Cavill like looks good in the role and like was brought some pathos to the role. Like, it was a weird version of the character, yeah. And it was a kind of a weird mashup of like Wolverine and Spider-Man and a bunch of other things, but at least like Cavill seemed interested. Again, just like Batfleck, now he's sleepwalking through the role. And
let's talk about the fucking mustache.
Yeah, the CGI mustache removal.
What the fuck? The weirdest decision of a movie. I know Warner Brothers' hands were kind of tied legally, but really, like, you couldn't get him out of his contract for Mission Impossible 6. He's fucking Superman.
Uh-huh.
He's your flagship character, and you're going to literally CGI his lip in?
Well, let's talk about the larger problem, which is the CGI in this movie is garbage.
Yeah.
It looks bad. It is an ugly film. And it, like, you know, say what you will about Zack Snyder, I'm not a fan, but the usually the one his thing that people kind of credit him with is the visuals, and that he, like, I think all of his stuff kind of looks like souped up Linkin Park videos, but at the very least, they like have there, he has an eye for like what's going to be a cool trailer shot. But
yeah.
In this movie, it's muddy. Like, there's no real like color palette or design to it. It doesn't even have that sort of aesthetic drive that you can expect from Zack Snyder. Like, maybe it's because he's mixing all these different characters that are individually have their own thing, and then when they come together, it just looks like a big blurry mess visually.
I know, it worked for the Avengers. Shots fired.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. But in this movie, like, And maybe I'm sure the production probably was rushed because they're trying to get this cinematic universe off the ground as much as they can, but it looks under rendered. Like, the CGI does not hold up to where it should be today. Fucking Steppenwolf, the villain. Yeah. Ugh. Good luck trying to get used to that name. And I know he's from DC, but like, come on.
Yeah. Really? No, I mean, his name's Steppenwolf, and there's never any explanation for that. It's just, that's his name.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know anything about him. He's just this weird CGI monster that shows up for these weird CGI MacGuffin
boxes. He's just a fucking Lord of the Rings character that shows up out of nowhere with, like, worse CGI than the actual Lord of the Rings movies from the early 2000s, and he does nothing. He's not threatening. Nobody gives a shit.
No, He literally, again, I've kind of done spoilers, but literally,
yeah,
like he just, like, I think the most anticlimactic movie I've ever seen.
And I complained about this sort of thing a little bit with, well, a lot of superhero movies, but specifically recently with the Wonder Woman thing, which kind of had a, like, boss battle at the end. This is like, that makes that look like a rich storytelling kind of experience compared to this.
Well, that's what I mean. This is like the boss battle, but then the boss is super easy to defeat.
Mm-hmm.
I will say I did kind of enjoy, I did have a couple like mini nerd moments, that almost brought me to this place of liking the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, when the Justice League has to fight Superman. I thought that was pretty fun.
That would have been a better direction for the plot, TBH.
Oh yeah, for sure. But just in general, that set piece worked for me. I liked that scene.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I know it was really dorky and corny, but when Superman shows up at the end and he's like, "I like truth and justice," I was like, "Huh, finally."
Ugh, like, nah. That was pandering.
But is it too much to ask for a little bit of decent pandering? Like, decent pandering. It's pandering, but it's pandering in line with the character, in line with the mythology that we know. It's not him cracking fucking General Zod's neck and letting buildings smash around him. It's like,
yes, but he has a moment where he's out of control and is killing everybody and is this world threat.
Okay, I'm gonna give him a little bit of credit for that, because it's this weird, like, he doesn't know who he is resurrection.
No,
moment.
But what I'm saying is, in every one of these movies, Man of Steel, Batman v Superman, and this, there is a really fucking good argument against Superman being on Earth. He is a problem. He is dangerous.
From the end of the movie on, it's like, okay, he's Superman.
I guess. I think by that time, for me, the movie was just so on, like, autopilot. I wasn't really...
Oh, no. I agree. It was just one of those things where when I see him show up in the blue suit and the red cape and he's like, "I like truth and justice," and he's literally saving a building full of people and then he's racing the Flash at the end, I'm like, fucking... Really? Like, couldn't we get some, like, whole movies featuring this guy as Superman?
How much did you care about Cyborg? Because I sure didn't.
No, not really at all. He's literally Deus Ex Machina as a character.
Yeah.
He literally is just like, oh, I'll find a way out of this situation with my cyborg powers that are not descriptive at all.
Right.
I do computers.
He seemed there for exposition reasons a lot, too.
Yeah, he was there to add another character.
Yeah, because they were wary about adding Green Lantern, which they should have just done. Well, I don't know. I don't really care. I think this movie's pretty bad, and the fact that it underperformed does... I mean, I think people are losing interest in this universe.
Oh, yeah.
Like, noticeably.
I mean, I think Batman v Superman was so bad that... Yeah,
and Wonder Woman did really well, was a surprise success. And I think people, the Warner specifically, thought that that would sort of launch Justice League. And this is it. Like, this is what it was all leading up to. This was their big hurrah. Like, this is why they sped through, you know, the normal process of setting up something like this. And this is it. And I think it's done worse numbers, at least domestically, than any of the movies previous.
Yeah. I mean, I think it would have been different if it was good. And it's just not. Like, it's just not good. Like, there's nothing to keep people coming back to it.
No. And it's so simplistic, you know, which is both a strength and a weakness. Strength, yeah, because it does make sense. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. But a weakness because it's like, it's
so by the numbers and boring.
It feels like it's written from like a how to write screenplay guide. Yeah. Like it's so, yeah, by the numbers, you know, connect the dots, whatever, analogy you want to use.
There's nothing challenging or exciting about it.
No.
It's just bland.
It doesn't complicate the characters in any interesting way. It doesn't push forth this movie universe in any kind of interesting way. I mean, Jason Momoa looked cool, but to me, he, like turning him into the group's Wolverine, like, you know, like chugging whiskey and then, like, throwing it off the dock into his home, the ocean.
I was so into that without his shirt on.
And the white stripes and blaring in the background. Like, to me, that's like that Zack Snyder, like cool for the sake of cool porn.
I don't give a fuck what you say. It was cool. With his badass beard and it was cool.
Eh.
Come on, are we really gonna go to fucking blonde Nazi poster boy lame ass talks to fish Aquaman? No, fuck that. Give me badass Wolverine in water.
I just didn't think it worked in this movie. And again, this has more to do with the fact that, like, none of these characters, with the exception of Batman, kind of, not really, and Wonder Woman, were introduced at all. You know, we get...
Don't worry, Cass. There's a director's cut. All right, let's move on.
Yeah, let's please. I don't abide.
Give it a letter grade.
I wrote my review already. It's a D plus.
Yeah, that's what I would give it.
Yeah.
Solid D plus.
Unenthusiastic D plus. Okay. I'll set up Lady Bird, which, right, again, you saw literally minutes ago.
Yeah.
An hour ago or so.
So these are my hot takes.
Hot takes. I saw this about a week ago. This is written and directed by actress Greta Gerwig, who, you know, kind of, she's sort of the queen of mumblecore, I guess. She came from that world, did the, like, Joe Swanberg and the Duplass brothers, and sort of came up through these films that are largely improvised. But then she became a couple or whatever with Noah Baumbach. They did the film Frances Ha together, which she co-wrote, and Mistress America. And now this is her foray into directing. And it's sort of based on her life. It's sort of based about her teenage years, loosely. And if you watch interviews, she talks about why her and the character of Lady Bird are not similar, but if it's pretty easy to see the things that she's drawing from. Lady Bird, Christine, played by Saoirse Ronan, is 17 years old. Saoirse Ronan, who's the famous Irish actress. She's playing Christine, who goes by the name Lady Bird. This takes place in 2002. And she's about to graduate, and she wants to get out of Sacramento, California, really, really badly. She wants to go to the East Coast to become a more cultured person and experience something than the small town she grew up in. And, you know, unfortunately, there's no way to really describe the movie in a way that really sells what it is, because everything that works about this movie, it comes from the soul and the heart of the movie, not necessarily what it is as a story, which is basically a coming of age story. I guess the big character arc that happens in this is between her and Laurie Metcalf, who plays her mother, and sort of the strained and complicated relationship between them. That also has a lot of heart and a lot of love there too, but it doesn't always show itself clearly. And Saoirse Ronan, as Lady Bird is going through this phase where she's trying on different personalities, depending on which group she's, you know, associating with. At one point, she decides she wants to be sort of a drama person, get into the spring musicals and that sort of thing. And then she kind of gets with a tougher crowd who's like going off into the parking lots to drink and that sort of thing. And she's trying to figure out what she's going to be when she leaves. And, you know, the two big emotional arcs in this movie that I think work really, really well is the one between the mother and daughter story. And I've heard Greta Gerwig describe this as a romantic comedy about a mother and a daughter instead of a couple. And then the other one is about a person and their home and their relationship to their home. And that being Sacramento and this. I love this movie dearly. I walked out of the movie with a huge smile on my face. This is one of those things, by like the first 15 minutes, I knew I was in good hands, and I knew that I wasn't going to be let down. And by the time I left the theater, I was so high on the movie that it actually put me in a good mood the next day. And I've been wanting to see it again since. And I suspect I probably will at some point. But what did Keith Foster think of Greta Gerwig's Lady Bird?
So sometimes with these kind of coming of age tales, you know, really indie, like you said, mumblecore-esque movies.
This is not a mumblecore movie, but
no. But I can see the relation to that style of filmmaking. It's not, but I can see how it has roots there, if that makes sense.
Sure.
Sometimes with that type of movie, it really depends for me. I can have trouble because things feel over dramatized or a little too funny or a little too self-serious. This isn't that. I loved it. That was great. Mm-hmm. This is just like, I don't know that there's another movie that captures what it was like growing up in the early 2000s like this.
I know. It's so made for our generation. It's sick. Like, there's a lot of inside baseball.
But not in like a hip, winking, pandering sort of way. In just a very honest, like, this is what life was like for this generation sort of way. Mm-hmm. And not in a way that's, again, my problem with these movies is they have a tendency to be overly dramatic or overly messaged, mm-hmm. or, you know, or overly hip. I don't think this was either of those. It's just funny enough and just serious enough to feel very real,
mm-hmm.
without being a big old fucking bummer.
Yeah.
And there was stuff that I thought was going to be that.
Agreed. I want to talk about the opening scene, because I think this describes what you're talking about perfectly.
Full disclosure,
mm-hmm.
I was like 2 minutes late.
Oh, okay. Well, good. Then I'll fill you in. So the movie opens up with Christine and her mother in the car. This really is like the prologue to the whole thing. And this movie, like some of my favorite movies, feels very literary. You feel like you're kind of reading a great novel. You know, the movie starts out with her in her car, and they're listening to The Grapes of Wrath on book on tape. And already in the movie theater, I'm like, are these going to be like these insufferable sort of like socialites? Like, you know, are they going to be like these kind of like barely human being characters who are just too smart and too cool?
Is this going to be a Gilmore Girls movie?
Exactly. But then right after this moment where they're both bawling listening to The Grapes of Wrath, which has a lot to do with Sacramento, and the movie also opens with a Joan Didion quote, who comes from Sacramento, a writer comes from Sacramento. Right after they have this emotional moment listening to The Grapes of Wrath, they immediately get into one of the most realistic arguments I've seen between mother and daughter. And the way it escalates, and the way these two actresses, who are just incredible in this movie and are, you know, really going back and forth very strongly throughout. And then it goes into this place where you're kind of uncomfortable with how real it's getting with this fight. And then it ends on a punchline, but in a way not like the Justice League movie that's not based in character at all. It ends in this really hilarious way and then cuts right to the title card. And it's a perfect introduction to the film. And it says everything, says everything about what this movie's going to be and the way that it subverts expectations for the genre. And mm-hmm.
I thought it was great, and all the characters are played with such a love,
mm-hmm.
and so well, and again the movie kept setting me up to be worried about the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like the fact that it takes place in a Catholic
high school,
mm-hmm. high school, and there's like this kind of overly sensitive father, priest teacher. And I'm like, oh, Jesus, can we get one Catholic movie without someone getting molested? Yes, we can. And that was delightful.
Yeah. There's a lot of love for this institution, even though Lady Bird is a character, and I think maybe Greta Gerwig as well. She ended up going to a Catholic school, not for the religious aspect of it, but to stay out of bad schools. Because, and we should have mentioned this at the top, this family is not doing very well financially, and
but I mean they're not doing well, but they're also not
they're realistically middle class, which is another thing we don't see in movies at all. People yes. are either dirt poor or science fictionally rich.
Exactly, and these people are getting by. Yeah, they're not.
This is how as most comfortable people live. As
they'd like to be, but it works for them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that was another thing I really liked about it is and how that affects the different dynamics of the family and how that informs Lady Bird of her opinion of Sacramento. And mm-hmm. again, you know, we grew up in a town. I mean, Sacramento's way bigger than Pocatello, but this felt like Pocatello.
It did.
This reminded me of when she just desperately needs to get out of Sacramento. Is like me needing to desperately get out of Sacramento or Pocatello.
Right.
Like there's just so much that I could relate to with this movie. And even the stuff that I couldn't relate to just felt so honest. And it was nice to go to a movie that's not overly plotty.
Right.
That's just like, let's just, the story is about human beings and how they grow and evolve, and one of the most formative times of a person's life between high school and college, and how that, you know,
right,
a lot happens.
And every character in the movie who, you know, I think Greta Gerwig does this really interesting thing, consciously or unconsciously, I'm not sure, but it's interesting coming from the world she comes with, especially the Noah Baumbach stuff, less so the Mumblecore stuff, but her, like Frances Ha, which this is almost sort of like, could be the prequel to Frances Ha, because the way that story, this story ends and that one begins is very similar, characters, but, she does a very interesting thing where she sets up these expectations for these characters in a really kind of arch way, like we've seen in other high school movies or other coming of age movies. And then by the movie's end, we've seen the full character and we realize they're not going to be as simple as we thought they were.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Especially
and that's one of the things I liked about
the father played by Tracy Letts, famous playwright and actor.
Mm-hmm.
He has a really interesting arc in the movie.
I was in love with him and completely heartbroken, but not in a way that like hangs over the whole movie. It's all subtext.
Right.
That's another thing. There's so much that you don't see or hear, but just like a kid growing up in that time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Also there's I don't think I've ever seen, at least in a while, I haven't seen anything that's made me as happy as when she chooses to go to the prom.
Yes.
Just that, like, character being totally honest with what she wants.
And who she is.
And just going for it and then meeting up with her friend. It just, right. just delighted
And her, the actress just, who plays her best friend, Beanie Feldstein, she's a delight. And she has there's such funny, like, there's stuff in this movie that, like, yes, it's an indie film, in air quotes, but there's a few things that I think, you know, especially from a first-time director, really, I thought she did very well. The movie, unlike something I was complaining about with my friend Dahmer a few weeks ago, this movie has a look, it has a style, it's kind of sun-dappled, there's a lot of sort of, like, earth tones going on in this. It's shot very, very well and competently. The way that, you know, shots are laid out is done with a lot of care. I feel like she's drawing from the greats as far as this genre goes. I feel heavy influence of, you know, films like Clueless. There's structural things that are very similar. And films like Fast Times at Ridgemont High, to go from another Amy Heckerling film. as well as the John Hughes things. Like, all that stuff is informing this, but in not in like a cool sort of like Tarantinian sort of like hip hop mixy sort of way. It feels very naturally integrated into what's going on.
That was one of my favorite things about it, was how not cool this movie is. And I don't mean that in a detrimental way. I just, it's not like knowing, it's not and winking, and it's not overly clever. It's just, it's not, that's not its point. Mm-hmm. Its point isn't it's not trying to be meta in any way and cut at what it was like to grow up in the early 2000s. It's just trying to show what that's like. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I thought it was great. I mean, it is officially the most popular movie on Rotten Tomatoes as far as or best reviewed movie
for the longest amount of time. Yeah.
With the most amount of critics.
Yes. Yeah. And for good reason. I mean, even Armin White, the famous contrarian, gave this a positive review, maybe accidentally.
I don't know. I mean, I guess if you're not in, I could see how, you know, if you are looking for like a complicated plot or whatever, I could see how maybe people who have been conditioned by modern cinema to expect flash and, you know, overly
slick, expensive production design and all of that stuff. Yeah, I think if you've grown up on a diet of nothing but big blockbuster action movies, you might not see what the big deal is.
Yeah, but you might think it's boring or whatever.
Or whatever. But I actually think that and maybe it has something to do with our ages and the fact that the movie's kind of written towards us, even though this is very much coming from the tradition of teen films and I think should be enjoyed by teenagers. And I think maybe young women in particular are going to respond to this movie in a specific way.
I agree. Mm-hmm. And I think that's great. And I wonder if it's, my only thing is like, is it too generational? Like, maybe it's not. You know, are you really connected with Clueless, even though that was a decade before your time, kind of thing?
But sure.
And I hope not. I hope, you know, I hope a teenager could see this and still relate to it. I don't know.
Well, the teen genre doesn't really exist anymore. It might exist on television, kind of. But in film, it's been pretty dormant for a while, since, like, at least Superbad-ish.
I mean, there have been some. You
peppered
know,
in there.
They're mostly indie movies, but...
Right, so you have your Junos and you have your whatevers, but...
Yeah, Perks of Being a Wallflower.
Right, and that movie has its fans, and I think people who like that will certainly respond to this. But I think the teen movie as we knew it, it's like a big, profitable, exploitable thing... kind of hasn't been a thing for a while. And so that's why a film like this, this came out in 1995 at the time of Clueless, this would have open wide release. This would have been, you know, a competitive movie in the market. They wouldn't have tried to sell this as a niche market thing. They would have sold this to teenagers. Nowadays, they're selling it to, you know, to be considered crowd.
Yeah. Hmm. I don't know. I really liked it, though.
I do, too. I think it's a perfect film, almost. I wish the movie would have ended maybe 3 minutes earlier.
Yeah, that was my only sticky note.
Yeah.
Is the very end feels a little bit...
there's an epilogue in the movie that I didn't think was necessary. I generally feel that about any movie that with an epilogue.
I don't necessarily, but it's literally like the last couple lines of the movie. Mm-hmm. I get, and I could appreciate, but I could also see how someone could take it very cynically as sort of baby boomer wish fulfillment.
And
that's my only thing, is I could see how that could be misconstrued.
my thing was that there's this, you know, kind of this voiceover thing that happens at the end, which sort of wraps everything up nicely. But I feel like the movie had already accomplished all the things that's said in the voiceover that we didn't need the movie to literally come out and say it. And I think on the page in a screenplay format, or again, like a novel, that would be beautiful and lovely and poetic and all the things it's meant to be. In a film, I don't think it's as necessary.
I agree. And I don't think it, I really don't think it, like, it doesn't ruin the movie or anything.
No,
like that. It's
not.
Just, it did.
It's my only note.
Make me go, okay. Yeah. No. Other than that, I agree. I think it's just about perfect. Just the amount of time and attention to detail on various things.
Mm-hmm.
And even the way it's edited.
Right.
Is very telling. Like, there's moments where she's very happy, like in, you know, backstage before the show, and she's laughing, but you don't hear what's really funny because those moments in your life are very fleeting. You don't really remember them. And I liked how the editing helped inform both the character's emotional state and just the story in general.
For sure.
And I think not enough editing lately
is conscious of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was very intentional.
All right.
A plus.
Oh, yeah. 100% for me.
Okay.
Let's get into
the Netflix award.
Let's get into what was supposed to be a Halloween review a month ago, almost a full month ago, before you went on your hiatus where you were kidnapped and held hostage for 4 weeks.
We're not doing that. I already told you we're not doing that bit.
This is Michael Haneke's American remake of his film Funny Games. It was previously made in Austrian, I want to say, in 1997, remade in 2007 with Naomi Watts and Tim Roth, Michael Pitt and Brady Corbett. Describe to me what happens in Funny Games.
It's a home invasion movie.
Mm-hmm.
Where this very wealthy family is at a vacation home, and these couple of strangers show up, and it's sort of weird at first and sort of a tense interaction, and it quickly dissolves into being held hostage and torture and murder.
And all the bad things.
Yeah. Okay. Where do I want to get started on this?
I'll preface this before, while you're getting your thoughts collected. I think I said this when I signed it, that this is a very divisive film. Michael Haneke is seen as sort of a one of the greats of world cinema, honestly. And he's, you know, he redid the film. What was it called? The French one with the old people that was nominated for Best Picture, and it was Amour, which was nominated for Best Picture, even though it was a foreign language film, which almost never happens. And he did the film The White Ribbon and all these things. But this movie that was famously booed at the Cannes Film Festival, which at the Cannes Film Festival, that doesn't mean a lot because they boo everything.
Really?
Yeah, it's famously like it's like the opposite of Sundance. At Sundance, everything gets a standing ovation, no matter how shitty it is. At Cannes, everything is booed, and people are very vocal about whether they like or hate something there. But yeah, so you know, the movie is very divisive in that way, and he said the reason he wanted to make this in English with an American cast, even though it's not anyone's favorite Michael Haneke film, is he said that the genre that he's exploring here, the horror film, and specifically this kind of horror film, has more of an interesting context for him in English in America.
Sure.
So, and by 2007, he had more of an American audience.
Sure. I basically hated it. I basically thought it was trash. you know, so I'm going to explain this to our listeners, mm-hmm. all seven of them. You know our ongoing joke of... It started, I think, with The Dark Knight, when you asked what I thought about it, and I said it was just Christopher Nolan jerking off all over the screen for 2 hours.
No, that was what you said to Richard, but yes.
Yeah.
You texted that to Richard after we walked out of the theater as a joke, because you really actually liked it, but you said that he was masturbating for 2 hours and calling it art, and then you forgot to tell him that you were joking for something like 2 weeks.
No! No, I told him right away.
So for 2 weeks, he thought that you had terrible opinions. But
no, I thought I told him right away.
No, that's why the story's funny.
Anyway, that's basically what I thought of this.
Okay.
From the get-go, from the opening sequence with the music, I was just like, here we fucking go. It's overly pretentious.
Okay.
It's so goddamn self-aware. I mean, there's literally a sequence that is just like, I hated it. It's just a bad movie, Cassidy. it's never even exciting like a home invasion or scary like a home invasion movie should be. It's just uncomfortable and not in a way that I think is intentional. It's just kind of, I hated it. I like the acting isn't good. The stakes never seem real. It never seems tense. I think it's kind of boring as fuck. And then it gets weird for no reason. Mm-hmm. That's not true. It doesn't get weird for no reason. It gets weird for super pretentious reasons. And then it just sort of ends. Everything you need to know about this movie is summed up with the pseudo-philosophical bullshit that Michael Pitt's character says at the very end on the boat.
Right, which I actually never really tuned into that bit of dialogue, and I rewatched it for the show. And I hadn't seen it in a really long time, I should say. I hadn't seen it since, like, almost when it came out. On DVD, anyway. I didn't see it in theaters.
It's okay if you liked it. I just didn't.
I have a more complicated opinion about it now than I did before. I don't think it's trash, and I don't think that it's a poorly made movie. I think
in a lot of ways it is, but anyway.
I actually think that it is a really well made movie. But I do think that it did register to me more this time, being 10 years older than I was the first time I saw it, as needlessly cruel and exceedingly unpleasant. Whereas before, I was more interested in the meta stuff and, like, what it was saying about the genre and, like, the conversation it's having with the audience, sometimes literally.
That's the stuff to me that felt so fucking pretentious that I was just, like, almost rolling my eyes.
Okay, yeah. I mean, but here's the...
And I was bored for a large chunk of it. I was straight up bored.
I mean, I like that steady camera stuff. But the still camera stuff. I like the minimalistic approach.
Sometimes I agree, but in this case, it did nothing to me to add to the tension of the film. To me, it just made things seem drawn out and boring and unrealistic. Like the whole confrontation with the golf club at the beginning, where they sort of incapacitate Tim Roth, just felt like fake to me. It felt very unreal.
I can see why some people would feel frustrated. Generally,
no, not some people. Me,
generally, with the movie, because these people, these characters, Tim Roth and Naomi Watts, who play Anne and George, Michael Haneke always names his male female leads Anne and George in his movies.
Jesus Christ, not doing anything to make me like this anymore.
But I can, because they don't really fight back all that much, or they don't fight back
no, okay.
effectively.
I, I, I should clarify. I did like Naomi Watts. I do think she turns out a pretty good performance. I normally kind of enjoy Michael Pitt. Mm-hmm. In this, I didn't really care for him. Same with Tim Roth.
I think there's some incredibly strong stuff, because what I think that what's interesting about the movie still to me, even though, like I said, I found the movie more just to be really unpleasant this time around and kind of stomach churning in not a fun way. Stuff that I thought was really still very effective was, especially that scene, the scene towards the middle of the movie when the home invaders leave for a little while to go do God knows what. There's these very, very personal moments between, Tim Roth and Naomi Watts where they're trying to figure out what they can do in a short amount of time. And there's some, and like they really look and seem emotionally wrenched. And I think the passage of time in this movie, like, I feel like I'm in that 24-hour time frame with them. I never feel like this movie's actually not that long, but it feels like you're there for that whole day. And I think some of that is because of the lack of edits, the lack of cutting, the more minimalistic approach camera-wise that I think actually works.
I guess I can kind of see what you're saying, but it didn't really work for me. That scene that you're talking about, that did.
The cell phone and all that.
Yeah, because you know that they're not gone for good. So for me, that was probably the most effective part. The sort of what's scary is, you know, is what's going to happen next kind of thing.
Right. And not even like a matter of scary in like a traditional horror movie sort of way. But I found them like to actually be the most tragic part of the movie because they're just so emotionally done and they're just trying to hold it together as much as they can. And I think that that's some effective acting and
sure. Corbett. And again, that sequence worked for me, but that was about it. That was really the only time in the movie that I even really felt any actual tension.
Even the pursuit with the kid in the other house. I thought that was some strong stuff on a genre level. That was probably the most, like, outwardly genre the movie gets.
That to me felt like pretty kind of cliche and dumb. Like, I didn't totally buy it. I mean, I don't know.
I'm not saying you had to like the movie.
I didn't.
But I was actually struck still by how well made it was, even though I think it's kind of it's so unpleasant that I don't understand why it was made now. I mean, I do, but I don't. I actually think Michael Pitt and Brady Corbett, and maybe I'm a little biased because this is sort of what introduced me to these actors at all. I never saw them in anything previous to this, so I never really had opinions about them before this. But I think that their performances are really chilling. And the way that they portray their characters is like, even as they've already done the most fucked up things you can believe, but they're still using please and thank you. And just these weird little power trips and head games they're playing with them throughout the whole thing.
No, I mean, I get all of that. It just didn't work for me. It was just like... Uh-huh. It was just not believable, and that not believability was literally taken to the utmost extreme with the whole remote sequence, which was just dumb.
Right.
That was dumb.
I think that's the sequence in the movie where you either that you're either with it or you're not. I think that's the point in the movie where where people are going to completely cut themselves off.
Yeah, and there wasn't any context for that throughout the rest of the movie, except these weird little fourth wall breaking looks that Michael Pitt would give. That even those, I was like, "What? What? I don't like that." Like that.
If we're talking about slasher movie, horror movies about, you know, that are about horror films, if we're talking about like sort of this idea of like the conversation between the audience and the film and the director and like why do people people want to watch films that are about violence and like movies about violence that are anti-violent.
That's not what this movie is about. This movie is about that conversation.
Yes.
And it's annoying.
Yes, that is something that people have said. I think it's vague.
It's annoying and pulls the rug out from any credibility that the film had.
Mm-hmm. But without that, it's even more cruel. I mean, it already is, but I think so, without the subtext of genre, then why is it
just like one moment in the movie? What's the point of it then?
There's like three or so. I think there's enough in there, especially the...
There's a couple little ones, and then one really big one that stands out like a sore thumb.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, that's the moment that is going to... You're either with it or you're really not. And I think a lot of people...
To me, that didn't really inform the movie. That just informed me of the director thinking he's smarter than me.
Well, it is very directed with a capital D. I think that a lot of people really don't like that about it. And I think a lot of people really feel like they're being chastised while watching it.
To me, it was just like, oh, okay, you can't even get through this movie. Like, you can't even get through this movie without showing me how smart you are. Cool. Like, maybe try to do that with subtext and character development.
I'll say this. If these are the things you're complaining about with this movie, which fair enough, that's the way you feel. Why don't you have the same problems with a movie like Scream, which I think does everything that this movie did better back in 1996? I will agree. And in a way that's a lot more palatable and fun to watch. But also
here's the thing, I don't have a problem.
Cabin in the Woods, or like there's a lot of movies that are
don't mistake my meaning. I don't have a problem with movies being meta.
Right.
I don't have a problems with movies having subtext about movies. Cool. I have a problem with a director flaunting it like a jackass and putting it into a place where it feels like it doesn't belong. Like the difference between Scream and Cabin in the Woods is there's an intertextuality context. Oh. It's what the movie's about from the get-go. Like, it's a part of the movie throughout the whole. In this, it's this weird little scene that completely takes you out of the movie if you're in it. Mm-hmm. And it's so brazen too. Like, maybe if it had been a little more subtle, like the little looks that Michael Pitt would give to the camera where it's like looking at the audience, sure, I could see that. Maybe escalate it a little bit. Uh-huh. Maybe have him break the fourth wall, but it didn't just break the fourth wall. It literally stopped the movie, rewound it. And I'm just like, oh, okay, cool. I'm done with this. So you don't care about the story at all. That's what this is about. I get it. I get you. That's what bothered me about it is I felt like this movie isn't about this story, about the two kids and about the family. It's about the director telling you he's a director. And that annoyed me.
I'm not surprised that that was your reaction to it. I knew that was a possibility.
On this podcast far too much.
we're politely disagreeing to agree. I think it isn't so much that it's a movie about a director trying to show you how clever he is, although it dangerously comes too close to doing that. And for a lot of people does. I think the movie's not even about whether or not these characters will survive in the fight and the battle and all of this stuff. This movie is about sadism, and it's about the cinema of exploitation selling itself on sadism and the complicated relationship that the viewer, the audience has with wanting to see violence and then at the same time being reviled by it. Because I think there's a lot of stuff in this movie that juxtaposes, mm-hmm. that juxtaposes the genre qualities of it with the realities of it. And I think that's a lot of what grates on people is it's like, it's a horror movie that doesn't want you to have fun. And in that sense, I think the clever stuff does work, but I also see why it gets under a lot of people's skin in a bad way.
Yeah. I can see that. It didn't work for me. I think, I don't know. In the fact that it's like a shot for shot remake of this movie mm-hmm.
by the same director
that he already made, like makes it even kind
of. And
grosser.
I've never seen the Austrian one. Of course, in like you know horror circles, there are the watch the first one and blah blah blah. But knowing that it's shot for shot, like it's like I don't really. I guess I'm sort of morbidly curious to see the Gus Van Sant remake of Psycho, but I kind of don't feel like I have to because I know it is a shot for shot remake. Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel the same way about the Austrian Funny Games. It's like, well, I've already seen this. Like, I don't know. So I don't know if I'll ever end up seeing it. But,
and just like the whole beginning, too, where they make their way into the house was like overly convoluted and dumb. Like the whole shit about the eggs. This movie spends like 20 minutes counting eggs, Cassidy.
I kind of like that. And I kind of like that stuff.
No, I'm like, come on.
I actually like that escalation. I think that works.
It didn't to me. it wasn't an escalation. It was just it didn't. There was very little I liked about this movie.
That's fair. That's fair. I would say, though, not to judge this director purely on this movie, because he is, Michael Haneke is one of the greatest working world directors today.
Well, it's very hard for me to not judge him on the only movie I've seen.
And this is his big punk rock fuck you. This is kind of his Clockwork Orange, which I would say there's a lot of Clockwork Orange stuff in this movie.
Yeah, but I think,
if we're talking about when I saw it the first time versus this time, and maybe this has a little bit to do with the stomach churning feeling I was getting through it, I find it kind of weird that they're dressed exactly like those Charlottesville fucks, so like with the TQ torches, which is like the official like alt-right costume now,
Well, these guys look like that. They look like, you know, they look like the American terrorists.
Right. Well, they look like rich country club kids, but yes.
Yeah, which is, that's what, you know, modern Nazis look like, Cassidy.
All right. What are you assigning me?
I mean, Michael Pitt would have given Hitler such a big old boner, he would have popped his dick off.
What are you assigning me for next week?
That was a weird note to go out on, Cass. Weird note to go out on for a weird movie. To make up for it, I think we need some Jewish heritage. Oh, this is getting worse. I want to abandon that segue. I'm assigning you the Netflix original movie, The Meyerowitz mm-hmm. Stories, starring Dustin Hoffman, Ben Stiller, and Adam Sandler.
Yes, directed by Noah Baumbach, who we were just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll do that next week. Okay, so if you have plugs, plug them.
I'm very glad we ended up reviewing Lady Bird, because I was getting pretty jaded after Justice League and Funny Games. Tonight in San Diego is on hiatus. You can still check out our website, check out our clips. We should hopefully get a bunch of clips from past shows up during this break. Our production team is going to be working on that. And we'll be back in March of next year. So it's going to be a little bit. yeah, so it's going to be a long break, but we're going to be doing some rebranding, some restructuring. Hell, I might not even be invited back. They're kind of rebuilding the show from the ground up. So it should be some exciting changes to look forward to.
All right.
Other than that, you can follow me on Twitter as long as it still exists and I still put up with it, at Keith Foster Kid. You can follow me on Instagram, which is much more my social media drug of choice lately, at Keith Foster Kid. Because you very rarely get people's opinions on Instagram. And you can maybe find me on Facebook. I don't know. I think I might be at Keith Foster Kid on that too. It's under my actual name, so I don't know. Yeah, and then I'm hopefully going to be getting some, hopefully have some new stuff, soon that's probably too early for me to even mention, but hopefully get some shows coming up.
Right. Okay, and if you want to follow the show on Twitter, you can at Jabber Podcast. You can follow me individually at BC Cassidy. You can email the show with any of your thoughts and opinions about anything we've talked about recently at jabberandrone@gmail.com. You can find the archives for the show at jabberandrone.podbean.com. And you can follow us and stream us on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Player.fm, Google Play, and Pocket Cast. And the Windows Podcast Network. I always forget we're on that one, too. And if you want to read my movie reviews that I do weekly for the Idaho State Journal, you can at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com, which I usually post at the bottom of every review. I usually post the most recent podcast that corresponds with the review given. So that's another place to listen to the show if you want to. And also, we have friends who do podcasts that you should be listening to, including Patrick and Dennis at Almost Educational, and Patrick and his father at Make Dad Read Comics, and Rod and Denise at The Listening Party, who are also rebranding coming up at the end of the year, or restructuring their show somehow. And Denise at the Mascot Diaries, Bill and Brian at the Great Albums Podcast, and Mike Fallick at Let's Start a Cult.
Yeah, that one's bonkers, but
fun. Yeah, that's a fun multimedia art project of a show.
not that the other podcasts aren't fun.
No, those are all great too.
But that one is strange.
Yeah, kind of a abstract experience. Okay. Yeah. And that's the show.
All right. Let's give it to Gosling.
All right. Bye.